Now, here's this week's featured interview. Hibakusha, which looks like hibakusha, is the term for those who survived the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But in recent years, it has come to be applied more widely to all who have been exposed to radiation from nuclear bombs and other sources of contamination from manufacturing, uranium mining, nuclear reactors, and radioactive waste. As today's guest will explain, that means just about all of us. Professor Robert Beau Jacobs is an American historian of nuclear technologies and radiation technopolitics. He moved to Japan in 2006 after being hired by the Hiroshima Peace Institute and is currently a professor at the Hiroshima Peace Institute and the Graduate School of Peace Studies of Hiroshima City University. He's also the author of the 2022 book Nuclear Bodies, the Global Hibakusha, and that's the basis of what we're going to be talking about. Beau has such a wealth of information to share that our interview ran well over 1 hour. So it's being presented in two parts as a bracket around the anniversaries of the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To clear up a few references that appear, note that in part one, Rongelap is in the Marshall Islands and was site of the U.S. A-bomb tests in the 1950s. And the Japanese fishermen on the boat Lucky Dragon were accidentally contaminated by nuclear fallout from the United States' Castle Bravo thermonuclear weapons test at Bikini Atoll in 1954. I spoke with Beau Jacobs on Friday, July 21st, 2023. Professor Robert Jacobs, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background and what brought you to this subject material?
In a lot of ways, I've had a non-traditional background in terms of academic work and doing this kind of work in the sense that I had four kids in my 20s. And so I began work on my bachelor's degree when I was 30 years old with four kids. And so I completed my doctorate in my mid-40s and started here at the Hiroshima Peace Institute when I was 45. And so, you know, I came into academia late, having, you know, been working and supporting a family for, you know, 25 years. So it's not a traditional academic route. And this has been the only place I've ever worked in academia is here at the Hiroshima Peace Institute. So I kind of had this odd route, ended up in kind of a place I hadn't anticipated being. And this is where I've spent my whole academic career. But in terms of the content and the topic, it's actually rooted in my childhood. As a child of the Cold War, I was taught how to prepare for nuclear attack in the 60s when I was in elementary school in suburban Chicago. And one of the things they told us was you always have to anticipate the flash because that's your first sign that the bomb has detonated. And then you do whatever they pretended you could do, duck and cover, get under a table, whatever you might supposedly do. And so I remember getting this training when I was 8 years old and going home and sitting on the front steps of my house and just anticipating, like waiting for the flash, like being vigilant, like waiting for the flash. And I had this sudden sense of my house and the school across the street just dissolving, and it just terrified me. And, you know, I've often thought that that was sort of becoming aware of my own mortality, but it was really connected with nuclear weapons. And so I was so afraid of nuclear weapons that my coping mechanism for it was to read about it and learn about it. And so in the next few years, what that meant was like biographies. That's sort of what there was to read when I was a kid. So I read about Harry Truman, Robert Oppenheimer, all of these people and the Manhattan Project. And in a sense, I've just never stopped reading about it in order to comfort myself or at least steel myself for the reality of these things.
I have much the same background, having come from the same era and the same history. Explain to us, what is the Hiroshima Peace Institute?
The Peace Institute is sort of a broadly defined peace institute. It was founded in the late 90s. In a sense, it was part of an early wave of Hiroshima's anxiety over how this memory would be continued once the generation of Hibakusha passed, which is, you know, very much the feeling here in town now. But it was modeled on things like CIPRI and sort of Northern European Peace Institute. Originally, there were people from multiple countries and multiple disciplines working on their specific topics. So we don't focus as an institute collectively, for example, on Hiroshima issues or nuclear issues. There's people that work on war crimes issues, people that work on politics in various regions, people that work on sustainability. So it's kind of a broadly defined peace institute. And I'm one of the people here, one of the handful of people here working directly on nuclear weapons issues. And some of the people working on nuclear weapons issues are working on abolition and security studies, which is sort of the traditional academic home for working on nuclear weapons. But my own work is very much on the other end of the spectrum. It's much more of a bottom-up how people experience nuclear things rather than how policies were set around nuclear things. 10 years ago, our research institute got integrated into Hiroshima City University. So now we're a research faculty of Hiroshima City University. And about 6 years ago, we began a graduate school in peace studies. So our home now is in the Hiroshima City University, but we still are a separate entity within the university.
One of the things that so impressed me about your book, Nuclear Bodies, A Global Hibakusha, is the human aspect you brought to even the most technical discussions. And this is an all-encompassing book. I think it's a reference book that should be on the desk of anybody who opposes nuclear, who wants to know more about it, who's writing about it. You managed to make it humane when you're talking about some of the most horrific things on the face of the planet. And I'm wondering, first of all, what inspired you to take the time and the effort and the energy to write this book?
Well, this book is really, in many ways, the outcome of a dozen years of field research, most of that conducted with my research collaborator, Dr. Mick Broderick from Australia. We began the research on what we call the Global Hibakusha Project in 2010. And especially in the next 8 or 9 years, we did multiple research trips to sites of nuclear contamination. Originally, the way we envisioned the project was that we were going to be gathering oral histories in communities near nuclear test sites. That's what the beginning of it was. And the idea at first was that we would do a non-epidemiological study. Because when you talk about people in the Marshall Islands, Kazakhstan, and many of these locations, whatever academic inquiries there typically were around these sites were epidemiological, like, you know, what kinds of cancers were developed and what percentage of the population. And we were looking at what people experienced and how people lived through this and how it altered their sense of the integrity of their own bodies and their own ecosystems. And so we gathered a lot of oral histories and visited a lot of these sites. And we began to extend that. We did a lot of interviews with so-called nuclear soldiers, people who participated in nuclear tests compelled by their governments of the nuclear weapon states, Americans, Australians, French, Brits, and also laborers who worked at nuclear test sites. So we began to expand out to essentially people who had experienced exposure to contamination, exposure to fallout primarily. And part of why we thought of it as the Global Hibakusha Project was that these histories had been siloed into national histories, like victims of U.S. nuclear testing, victims of U.K. nuclear testing. And we looked at this as sort of a political structure that limited one's sense of the harm. If it was people living in southern Utah, downwind from the Nevada test site, well, that's really tragic, obviously, but it was X number of people. But really, when you step back and you look globally at this history as a collective history, because what the people who live near these sites experienced, what the soldiers experienced, what the laborers experienced, was essentially a collective history. I mean, it really didn't matter which country it was that was exposing them to fallout and radiation. You know, their experiences were of a type. So we started to think of this as a global history and this as a global community, so that when you pull back from using nation states to define this history and instead think of it as a collective, because that's how the planet experienced it, you're talking about millions of people. And suddenly you begin to see the scale of harm that was done to so many people. And so as Mick and I were doing this field work, other things came in as well. We began to include other sites, nuclear accident sites. And of course, soon after we began this project, Fukushima happened. And one of the things that was, for me living here in Japan, when Fukushima happened was watching the kind of discourse of management of nuclear anxiety just kick in again. And people saying, for example, the government saying, well, hopefully there won't be any serious health impacts, and realizing, well, this has never happened without serious health impacts, and they know that. And so this is just a discourse to manage people's uncertainty and convince them that things will be okay. So watching the mechanisms of managing anxiety and sort of dismissing people's concerns over health, it began to also focus me a lot on the nature of radioactive fallout, the way people experience it, and the way that it's been kind of minimized in this history. So as well as starting off as kind of a history of exposed communities from Cold War nuclear testing, it sort of broadened into a larger nuclear project. And eventually, because all of this stuff heads in this direction, it began to include waste issues as well.
One of the things that so impressed me about the book was how you seamlessly wove all of these different complex, as you said, siloed subject areas into a cohesive, continuous narrative that did keep the human focus. It weaves together the narrative threads from technology, science, politics, the military, to its impact on the innocent bystanders who were often indigenous people or people who had absolutely no power in the situation and didn't even know what they were up against until years later when suddenly there were health consequences. It showed up in the next generation and more information was revealed. How did you determine a means of structuring or weaving this information together into a coherent narrative?
That took a lot of time. It took a lot of time to sort of figure out how to tell this story in a way that didn't make it a bunch of separate stories, you know? And so in a sense, my own training in academically is in history of science and technology. So that sort of gave me a departure point, was that I think it's really important to understand the technological nature of these weapons and of harm from radiation in order to understand how this history operated both physically and also politically. But spending this time, spending this dozen years basically immersed in these communities and going from one to another, it began to seem like one story. And so part of what the challenge for me was how to tell it that way. And so it took me quite a while. I wrote the later chapters of the book first because they were a little bit more self-evident to me. The last chapter, which is about the legacy of nuclear waste, of high-level nuclear waste, that's sort of a standalone chapter, but it's the dumping ground of the whole rest of the book. It all gets dumped into the nuclear waste, of course. Originally, looking at the nuclear test sites, I began to, obviously, the first thing that comes out, as you said, was that the communities that are selected to be irradiated are essentially communities that cannot politically keep this from happening. So test sites are located in colonial, post-colonial places or near ethnic or religious minorities. And so these communities that were selected to have these sites be upwind from them were really each nation that made a choice of where to put the test sites used a similar kind of decision-making, which is how can we keep this fallout away from people who are important? And so that's another way of saying who isn't important. That was a fairly straightforward story. That's a chapter called Selecting the Irradiated. To lead up to how we got to those places, to talk about how people are harmed and how ecosystems are harmed by fallout and what the results of fallout deposition into ecosystems is, and then the anxieties that people have, that took a little while to figure out how to structure the first two sections of the book. Essentially, what I came down with once I was really working on the book as a manuscript was that it has to start with describing how people are harmed by radiation and how specifically people are harmed by fallout. And then to talk about how the ecosystem is impacted by fallout, because there's the event of fallout. There's when the fallout comes down and people experience harm. For example, the people in Rongelap and the fishermen on the Lucky Dragon and these communities, the fallout comes down, people are harmed. That's an event that happens at a time. But one of the things that we saw from traveling in nuclear test sites was some people were evacuated from contaminated ecosystems. Other people were left in contaminated ecosystems. And for those communities, you saw far more health impacts on people, third and fourth generation people who were, in a sense, living in contaminated environments. So the way that the risk was ongoing, I felt like I needed to spell out how fallout harms human beings and how fallout moves through the ecosystem once it's deposited. Once having established that, then I could move on to the kinds of anxieties people face when they have this uncertainty, when they're living in contaminated places where the risk is ongoing and the risk for their children is ongoing. So I started with the properties of the risk, the properties of the ecosystem, then what it's like to be a human being in these places. And then from that, how politicians made decisions about who has to endure this and who doesn't have to endure this. And finally, the fact that we are inflicting these decisions on thousands of generations and the people who have no choice through filling their world with our nuclear waste, which is not something we might do. It's something we've already done.
After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was, of course, horror at the fireball, the explosion, the devastation, the number of people who were killed immediately. But then came radiation after that, which had horrific impacts starting days, weeks, months afterwards, and then continued, and has now been tracked in the wake of those two explosions. There is something called the Lifespan Study, which was started after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and is considered to be the gold standard for describing the health impacts of radioactivity, radiation, fallout. But there are limitations to that study. Tell us about that and how it plays out.
That's an essential question and an essential part of how the book makes sense of this history. At the time that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were attacked with nuclear weapons, you know, there had been maybe a few hundred people who had suffered harm from radiation that had been studied. You know, a lot of uranium miners had suffered harm from radiation. But in terms of our models of how radiation causes health problems, there had been a very limited number of people. And suddenly, after the nuclear attacks here in Japan, there were hundreds of thousands of people exposed to radiation. So as historian Susan Lindy has pointed out, this was considered by researchers to be this incredible opportunity to create a database to track the health of all of these hundreds of thousands of people and create a database so that we have a model for how exposure to radiation eventuates in illness and early death. And so this study was begun soon after the occupation began here in Japan in the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, which was set up by the United States during the occupation to study the Hibakusha. And there were multiple different studies that they did, and they did really pioneering work in a lot of ways. But the study that's become the most important study in terms of the way that it has been used in the years since then is the Lifespan Study that you mentioned. Lifespan Study began in 1950. And the basic idea of the Lifespan Study is that you take two data points. One, how much radiation was someone exposed to? Two, what illnesses did they develop? How many years later? And did they experience early mortality? And you put this together for 100,000 people and you have a database whereby when someone is exposed to radiation, you can say, okay, you were exposed to this much radiation. So now you have this percentage chance of developing this cancer, this percentage chance of developing that cancer. And you can basically assess what are likely to be the health impacts of radiation exposures. This is the idea of the Lifespan Study. And so it's a huge database and it's very robust, but there are limitations to it. And this is exactly where this all gets political. When we're exposed to radiation, there's two different ways that we're exposed to radiation, externally and internally. So for example, when a nuclear weapon detonates, there's energy that radiates out from this explosion. You have heat, you have blast, and you have radioactive waves. So all of these are forms of energy that burst from the center of the detonation. They go out here in Hiroshima, they extended out about 3 kilometers in every direction, and they dissipate as they go further out. So blast, you know, destroys things, heat sets things on fire or burns things. And the burst of gamma radiation, the radioactive waves, harms people that are inside of that, say, 3-mile zone away from ground zero. But the gamma waves, the external waves that come through your body from outside of your body, they last less than a minute. So you have to be in that place when the weapon detonates for this radiation to harm you. One way to look at that is that it's like a gigantic X-ray. You know, when you get an X-ray, you're waiting, then the X-ray is turned on, the X-ray is turned off. During the period of time the X-ray is on, there's radiation passing through your body. It makes a photo of your tooth or your bone or whatever it might be. When the X-ray is turned off, there's no more radiation. That's what it's like when the weapon bursts, the gamma waves burst, they pass through everything, they pass through people's entire bodies. If you're close enough to get a large dose, it damages cells, it damages organs, it can cause illness quickly if you get a high dose, it can cause cancers later if you get a lesser dose. And so this is one of the immediate impacts of the detonation of the weapon. But the other is radioactive fallout. And radioactive fallout is particles, it's not waves. It's little pieces of different types of chemical matter that ionize, so they're radioactive. Some of it is material from the weapon itself. Some of it is, for example, here in Hiroshima or in Nagasaki, some of the uranium-235 or the plutonium that didn't fission is just spread out. Some are fission products. These are chemicals that are radioactive chemicals that are created by the process of the nuclear explosion itself. Other material is ionized, it's made radioactive by the explosion. So for example, when you look at a film at the Nevada test site, say, of a mushroom cloud, of a nuclear explosion, what you see is this huge column of material going up into the fireball, rising up into the fireball. It's filling up with particles, and a lot of them are ionized radioactive particles. And this is why there's a mushroom, is this, the top of the cloud is filling up with these particles. So these are radioactive particles, and they stay radioactive. It's not like X-rays or gamma waves. It's not like there's a wave that passes through you for a minute and then it's gone. These are pieces of material that remain radioactive. And as the cloud drifts, these particles fall back down to Earth, and they're dangerous to us, not externally, unless there's a ton of them. They're dangerous to us if we get them inside of our body. And we get them inside of our body through inhaling them or swallowing them in food or water. And then if we get these particles inside of our body looks at them as chemicals. So for example, one radioactive particle, a fallout particle that many people have probably heard of from nuclear testing, is strontium-90. There was a lot of anxiety about strontium-90 during the period of atmospheric nuclear testing. Chemically, strontium-90 is similar to calcium. So if you get a particle of it inside of your body goes, oh, calcium. And so it puts it into the bones or into the teeth. This is why strontium-90 is in the teeth. Other particles go to different places. For example, radioactive iodine. When the body gets iodine, the body puts iodine into the thyroid gland. If it happens to be radioiodine, which is iodine-131, it puts it into the thyroid gland. It says iodine. This is what we do with iodine. So the body takes these particles, if you get them inside of you, and it uses them the way that it uses any chemicals that you intake through food and other ways. Now, depending on the particle, it remains radioactive for a different period of time, you know, radioactive iodine for less than a year or two, but strontium-90 for 300 years. And so if this particle is deposited in your body, it's possible for some people, they may pass it out. Like the reason people take iodine pills, if there's a nuclear disaster, is you fill your thyroid up with good iodine. And then if you get, you know, radioactive iodine, your body will flush it because you don't need iodine. If your body hangs on to this particle though, it gives off a very, very small amount of radiation. If it was outside of your body, it wouldn't really cause much of a risk to you. The level of energy is very low. But if it's inside of your body, it's giving this energy off to the cells around it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And this could be, in the case of strontium-90, for the rest of your life. And so these particles, if internalized, will often also result in cancers, immune disorders, and other diseases. So it's a different form of exposure. Now, why the lifespan study is important is because in 1950, at the time when this study began, it was not possible to figure out if people had particles inside of their bodies or not. And so that was simply left out of the study. It was assumed by scientists at the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission that anybody in Hiroshima or Nagasaki that got particles inside of them also had probably been exposed to a huge amount of external rays as well. So they simply left internal exposure out of the study. And that's fine. it was not science that was possible to do. I don't personally think of this as conspiratorial. I don't think they left it out in a sneaky way. It was just not easy science. It was impossible at the time. So it was excluded from the study. So the study was built on how much external radiation were you exposed to. So the model we have that is used whenever people are exposed to radiation is the lifespan study. As you mentioned, it's the gold standard study. It's what it's always called. So in order to assess if people have risk from radiation, what we do is we measure external levels of gamma radiation. We take a Geiger counter, we measure how much radiation is this person receiving in their body, from outside of their body, from the radiation in the atmosphere. And we say, okay, your risk is related to that amount of radiation. But that's not the way people have been harmed. So in a sense, one way to put it is that our models of harm from radiation that were built in Hiroshima and Nagasaki assumed that in the future, people would experience what people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki experienced, which is they would be exposed to the detonation of nuclear weapons. But that's not what happened. Instead, we had 2,000 nuclear weapon tests and nuclear accidents. And there were very few people close enough to these to receive a giant burst of gamma radiation. What there were millions of people living where the fallout came down. So their risk from radiation is not similar to the risk as people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we take a medical model built on what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we use that to dismiss their anxieties. For example, after Fukushima, the only people exposed to high levels of gamma radiation were the people in the plants where the meltdowns happened. But there were four explosions which carried a lot of particles downwind and contaminated an area primarily to the northwest. We've all seen these contamination maps in Fukushima. Those people are living where particles came down. So you can hold a Geiger counter up, and the Geiger counter can show a low level of radioactive exposure. And using the lifespan study, we can say, oh, this level of radiation is so low, there will be no health problems from it. But that's not the way that people are experiencing the harm. The way they're experiencing the harm is they're getting particles inside of their body. And because these particles came down in forests, these particles came down in rice fields, these particles came down across an entire ecosystem, once those particles deposit in the ecosystem, they move through the ecosystem, they transport through the ecosystem. And so the people who live in those areas are much more likely to experience harm by eating food, or drinking water, or somehow getting particles inside of themselves, sometimes years later. And the lifespan study tells us nothing about those risks. It tells us nothing about the harm that's done when that happens, but it is the tool we use to dismiss people's anxieties about radiation. Now, I don't think the study is a bad study. It's just used badly. Instead of saying, according to the lifespan study, you will have no harm from radiation, what should be said at test sites, what should be said at Chernobyl, what should be said at Fukushima is, according to the lifespan study, you are not at high risk of disease from external levels of radiation. However, there are a lot of radioactive particles distributed into the ecosystem, and you are at risk of illness from these particles. And we can't tell you whether that risk is high or low because it's really widely distributed and unevenly distributed. So that's the truth about the risk that people face in test sites, in Fukushima, in Chernobyl. But that's not what they get told. What they get told is, according to the lifespan study, you have nothing to worry about. And so when people develop illnesses later and they say this is related to the radiation, when whole communities are experiencing higher levels, then it will be said, well, it's a lifestyle thing. Some people smoke. Maybe your diet's not good. And internalized cancers and immune disorders that eventuate from internalized particles take longer to present than cancers from being exposed to a high level of external radiation. So 20 years later, it gets dismissed.
Professor Robert Bo Jacobs. He is an American historian of nuclear technologies and radiation technopolitics, currently at the Hiroshima Peace Institute, and he is also author of the 2022 book, Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha. We covered so much ground in our interview, as I said before, there was no way to fit it into a single nuclear hot seat. So you can hear the conclusion of our interview on next week's show, Nuclear Hot Seat number 633. In the meantime, we will have links up to Bo's book and his website, bojacobs.net, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 632. Activate.